From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Jim Abbott is my guest. His new book, Jackson C. Frank, A Clear, Hard Light of Genius, tells the story of a folk singer from the 60s, a contemporary of Dylan and Tom Paxton and Phil Oakes, who dated Sandy Denny and had an LP produced by a young Paul Simon. Jackson C. Frank's story is a moving one and is told very well by my guest, Jim Abbott. Welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me on.
You know, even if one doesn't recognize the name Jackson C. Frank, they'd probably recognize at least one of his songs, Blues Run the Game. So let's begin by listening to that recording, which can now be found on this great 3-CD set, the complete recordings of Jackson C. Frank.
Well, it's a classic now, and I guess it was a classic the minute he first performed it, or when people first heard it, but even in the States today, though, I don't know that a lot of people really know it.
Catch a boat to England, baby, maybe to Spain. Wherever I have gone, wherever I've been and gone, wherever I have gone, the blues are all the same. Send out for whiskey, baby, send out for gin. Me and room service, honey, me and room service, babe, me and room service, well, we're living a life of sin. When I'm not drinking, baby, you are on my mind. When I'm not sleeping, honey, when I ain't sleeping, mama, when I'm not sleeping, you know you'll find me crying. Try another city, baby, another town, wherever I have gone, wherever I've been and gone, wherever I have gone, the blues come following down. Living is a gamble, baby, loving's much the same. Wherever I have played, whenever I throw them dice, wherever I have played, the blues have run the game. Maybe tomorrow, honey, someplace down the line, I'll wake up older, so much older, mama, I'll wake up older, and I'll just stop all my trying. Catch a boat to England, baby, maybe to Spain. Wherever I have gone, wherever I've been and gone, wherever I have gone, the blues are all the same.
Jim Abbott, your book, Jackson C. Frank, The Clear, Hard Light of Genius, begins with the recording session that for that song in London in 1965. But before we get to that, why don't you tell us a little bit about the early tragedy that really came to shape the life of Jackson C. Frank?
Oh, it was March 31st of 1954 in Cheektowaga, New York, a suburb of Buffalo, at the Cleveland Hill School. Because there are a lot of new families coming, an influx of, I guess, business and other things were, had drawn a lot of families to Buffalo, and the public school there was overflowing. So they built a temporary wooden annex with which they, to fit more of the kids. And one of the rooms in the annex was a music room. Since it was temporary, it was just wooden. And unfortunately and coincidentally, at the same time they were building this wooden structure and using it, coal dust and other gases and things from a faulty boiler in the basement of the school were, accumulating in the rafters and, the upper areas of the school and down the hallway. And at some point on that morning, on March 31st, something ignited it, and it was just like a fuse, and the room basically exploded in flames. And there were 39 kids in the room at the time, and 15 of them didn't make it out.
And Jackson C. Frank was how old when this occurred?
He was 10 when it happened.
Mm.
He was 11. He was 11.
I see. And he made it out, but was severely burned.
Oh, yes. He was burned over probably about 60% of his body. He was the worst burn to survive. And, in fact, Life magazine, for the issue that had a lot of pictures from of the fire in the class, the kids in the classroom, showed a picture of his parents keeping vigil over him. And the caption says, doctor said he might not survive. But he did.
He did. And you said in the book that doctors had to fuse one of his arms bent and one of his arms straight, but it just so happened that that worked out with playing the guitar.
Kind of. Yeah, they were both bent pretty, they were curved. Mm-hmm. It wasn't comfortable for him, but it had to be that way, to eat and to, do other cleaning functions and all that stuff, hygiene.
Yeah,
they had to do it several times because, after the fire, his body temperature shot up to 108 degrees.
Wow.
Now, when was the last time you heard anyone with a temperature like that?
Yeah, it's amazing.
It stayed up there for quite a while, and the parathyroid glands in his throat, everybody has them, they're in your neck and your throat, they regulate calcium. And he was getting a lot of intravenous fluids, like as all the kids were that were burned. And the excess fluid, because these glands shut down, the excess calcium, I should say, just started to settle in his joints instead of, going out in his urine. And so his joints became clogged up with calcium.
Mm.
And it became a lifelong, awfully painful condition for him.
So in addition to being a person who was in pain for his whole life, what was there, to what degree did the fire affect his ability to have a normal life and a successful career?
100%. Because, in my opinion, he didn't have a normal life.
No.
His mother went to extraordinary degrees of, of motherhood to try to make his life as normal as could be. She was a very doting, good mother, a great mother. But still, his life was always going to be pain. His life was always people feeling sorry for him. Because of the way he looked, and he hobbled, and his hips were kind of strange looking. It's kind of like watching a fat duck walk down the street. And I don't mean that with any disrespect to him.
Yeah, no, obviously not. So he at what point in his life did he pick up the guitar and start singing and writing songs?
When he was young, one of his teachers that would come to his hospital room to teach him, because kids need to be tutored. His name was Charlie Castelli, and he played the guitar. So he would bring the guitar, and they would work on songs together, relating to Civil War things and other lessons.
What led him to come to England or to pursue music as a career then?
A woman, same as everybody. He was dating a Mohawk Indian Irish lass, I believe that was the mix, or Scottish, named Kathy Henry.
Uh-huh.
She was from Buffalo also, and they were going out together for quite a while, and then things started to fall apart, so she decided she needed a break from Buffalo, from New York, from Jackson, from everything, so she was going to England. So Jackson just invited himself along because he didn't want to give up on her. And it was on that trip on the Queen Elizabeth that you know, he supposedly wrote all of the songs.
So he hadn't written any songs, and he gets on a boat and just writes an album's worth of great folk songs?
Yeah, yeah, that's that's sort of how it works, right?
Wow, well, that's pretty incredible, because there's some pretty strong songs in that first batch. I mean, all through his life, he wrote interesting songs, but he only made one actual professional record, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, so yep.
And that was released, never released in the United States until now.
No. Nope. And yeah, okay, it is out there now. Yes, that's
yeah.
A part of that set.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. December 10th, 1965. It came out in England. Just several thousand copies were pressed. Paul Simon had. We're jumping ahead here, but Paul Simon liked what he heard when they were rooming together in London.
Huh.
And decided, said, "Hey, I want to make a record for you. Let's go and get in the studio."
How did they happen to meet?
There's a woman in England named Judith Pieppi, whose life story is completely interesting on its own. But she was a non-person for a while with no country. She Silesia, that's the country she was from,
uh-huh.
And it doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
And
I think you made it up, Jim Abbott.
Yeah, no, it's part of Prussia or something. Anyway, more on her later.
Yeah.
But she somehow ended up in London as a social worker, and she liked folk music. She thought that the young, you know, people like Paul Simon, young folk singers, had a lot more to say to people than other musicians, because, you know, cause they were thoughtful with like the words that they wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of agree.
Sure.
That's why we sometimes tend to value musicians, songwriters' opinions so high. But anyway, she started to see Paul Simon playing in little places in London in like late 64, early 65, I guess it was. Simon and Garfunkel's first album, Wednesday Morning 3 a.m., had come out and had not done well at all. So he was kind of discouraged, so he went to London to seek, you know, his fortune there. And he was starting to make a name for himself, and she saw him playing somewhere, and she was doing a religious radio show on Sunday mornings for an hour, I believe it was. And she lobbied the BBC to let her bring him on and do some folk songs on the radio, and do it on the religious hour, and they let her do it, and that kind of kicked his career off in another way. But she started to, but she invited him to come stay at her house, which he did. And I know he's a shy kind of character, but there were all kinds of folk singers there. I mean, Al Stewart was there, and Sandy Denny was there, and then when Jackson came, Jackson was there, and she only had a couple rooms, so she would just throw people in rooms together.
Making history, and she didn't even know it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So Paul Simon ended up producing this session for
mm-hmm.
Jackson C. Frank, and Paul Simon subsequently, with Simon and Garfunkel, recorded that song we heard earlier, "The Blues Run the Game."
Yes, they actually recorded it as a B-side, I guess, but it was never released for the Sounds of Silence album.
Catch a boat to England, baby, maybe to Spain. Wherever I have gone, wherever I've been and gone, wherever I have gone, the blues run the game.
And of course, Sandy Denny also recorded this song.
Catch a boat to England, baby, maybe to Spain. Wherever I have gone, wherever I've been.
She recorded her version, the one and only one I know of hers, it's a bootleg.
Yeah.
It's like a demo or something, but and it kills me, the high note she hits.
So what was your opinion of Jackson C. Frank as a singer? I mean, obviously you're fond of him as a songwriter. Did you think he had a great singing voice?
He did. I thought he had a powerful, strong voice. And people I talked to about his early years before, you know, making the record said, oh, when he would play in the coffee houses around Buffalo and Toronto, it was with a big authoritative voice, and he'd stomp his foot on the stage. It was very compelling to watch.
We're talking with Jim Abbott, and he's just written a book that's a biography of Jackson C. Frank, and it's called Jackson C. Frank, The Clear, Hard Light of Genius. And I read a book not too long ago that we had here on From the Bookshelf about Sandy Denny, and Jackson C. Frank featured prominently in that story. So how did they went together for a while, or how'd that work out?
To the best of my knowledge, Jackson didn't talk about her much. And what he did tell me wasn't very, not for radio audiences, but
okay.
Guy talk. They met at Judith's. She was a nurse at the Brompton Chest Hospital, and she would, and an aspiring musician singer, but she would come by. I think Al Stewart may have invited her, and she would come and just sit in. She would sing, but she didn't play the guitar at that point. And Jackson started to teach. Well, she started to learn from him. I don't know if he consciously taught her. I know the claims are that he, you know, he's the reason she's became a singer, but I think she was headed that way anyway.
Yeah.
But one day, Al Stewart heard her playing the Dylan's Ballad of Hollis Brown, and she was playing it pretty well. And he said, "I didn't know you do that." And she said, "Well, I don't when Jackson's around. He doesn't like it when I play guitar."
I see. You made him jealous, or what?
I guess. He had a little competitive jealous streak in him, I noticed, you know, later on in life.
Yeah.
Which is good. I mean, at least, you know, you still have the fires burning. But one night when it was time, you know, it was nighttime, time to go to bed, Judith just paired the two of them. She thought Jackson and Sandy were an item, so she just paired them two in the same room.
So they were an item by morning.
Yeah, they sure were.
Jim Abbott, tell us what happened. After he made his first album, why didn't he make a second album and a third and a fourth and a fifth?
Well, he went over in '65 with chasing his girlfriend Kathy Henry, and things happened along the way where she didn't have enough money, and he had gotten all this insurance money after the fire. And when he turned 21, for about $100,000, which in 1965 money was a lot.
Yeah.
And
well, he could have lived off that for the rest of his life.
Yeah, ask his mother. You know, his mother was trying to get him to, like, buy property and invest in property, and but he just wanted to buy cars, expensive cars, because he was filled with survivor's guilt.
Yeah.
You know, one of the worst cases of it ever, maybe. He didn't want the money. He felt bad having it. So he would. A friend of his told me a story how they went Jaguar shopping in Buffalo, and he drove one right off the showroom floor, paid cash for it. They drove it about 20 miles on the New York State Thruway. It had no oil in the crankcase, and it seized up at an exit.
Oh God!
So they got a ride back to the place and bought another one.
Oh my God!
Yeah.
Wouldn't it have been more cost efficient to simply put the oil in there? I guess it wouldn't.
Well,
have been.
The engine seized up, which means it melted together. It got so hot.
So it's dead by then.
That's the end of that's the end of the car. Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
I know. People have cut their wrists over less.
Wow. So did he squander his entire inheritance or whatever? I guess it's.
Yeah. When you say squander, yeah, he bought a lot of cars. He bought a lot of guitars, and he had them shipped over to England, and he would sell them over there at a profit, big profit, because he'd buy Martin guitars.
Mm.
Nobody had them over there at the time. You know, it was a very rare thing to have a Martin guitar, you know, a really nice guitar like that. And, you know, he had all kinds of them.
Hmm.
And they'd go to gigs, like, he'd pull up in one of his expensive cars and, you know, pick up Al Stewart. They'd just throw their guitars in the back seat and go off to the gig somewhere. You know, and Al Stewart told me, you know, folk singers didn't have expensive cars. They didn't have cars at all, and usually really cheap guitars, you know, if anything. And here's Jackson with all this, you know, and he'd wear a bowler hat and a tux sometimes. You know, just being dapper to the end, I guess.
So you feel that this survivor's guilt and this, I guess, what you would even call a post-traumatic stress disorder, prevented him from pursuing a career as a normal singer-songwriter might have done.
Yes. After the record came out, he stayed in England and he toured around a bit in Europe, but mostly just around England, you know, around and around. And it was very, because Dylan was now gone electric, the folk scene over there didn't have a real strong, like, American performer to emulate. And Jackson sort of became their de facto idol, in a way.
Hmm.
You know, young players, you know, extremely good players like Bert Jansch and John Renborn, you know, they sat at his feet practically. And then he started to act strangely. And do some really strange things, and he was hospitalized for a time. And I have a letter. His mother had sent me a bunch of letters, and one of the letters is from a doctor over there, a psychiatric hospital, who said that Jackson had no chance to make a living as a folk singer over there, and best he'd be advised to get back to the United States and get treatment and whatever, you know, and live his life there.
Yes.
Which is what he did, and you know, he came back to. He had been to Woodstock, New York, and visited, you know, which is about 7 hours from Buffalo, and had liked it there, and some friends had lived there, so he decided he wanted to go to Woodstock, so that's what he did. And he took a job at a newspaper, editing and writing columns, some of them very funny, some of them so dense with literary references I couldn't even tell you. His intellect was amazing.
And I should tell our listeners that you reprinted some of those in the book, which is called Jackson
yes.
C. Frank, The Clear Hard Light of Genius. Well, Jim Abbott, you, at some point, you not only became acquainted with Jackson C. Frank, but you became his legal guardian. How did you happen to meet him, or what led you to meet him?
The story goes, and it's the truth because it's my story. 1983, a copy of Al Stewart's Year of the Cat album showed up in a used record store in Woodstock, New York, and I used to frequent quite a bit because I lived in that county. And it was signed, in regards to Jackson, the Blues Run the Game, Al. And the store owner told me, that I asked him who Jackson was, and he said he was a street character who used to come in and would sell, like, his, you know, belongings and records and stuff for food money. And I said, what's he look like? Because I was I'm interested in things like that. When somebody does something strange like that, you know, or unusual, my antenna go up. And he described him and said he was scarred all over his face and hands from, he thought it was an explosion of a car battery or something. And anyway, I ran around town trying to find him, you know, only to have about four people tell me that he had just gotten on a bus for somewhere. A few years later, I picked up a copy of John Renborn's version of Blues Run the Game, and I, you know, found out that it was a song, and it was composed by Jackson C. Frank. And so I set out trying to find that album. And I would get every rummage sale, yard sale, used record store, I would look for this album, and I didn't even know what it looked like, because this is pre-internet. When I was going to college in 1993, the communications professor head, you know, the department head, I should say, Mark Anderson, we were talking about folk CDs, and I asked him I said, you ever heard of Jackson C. Frank? And he just looked at me and said, yeah, I just got a letter from him. I said, do you have his album? He goes, yeah. He said, ooh, would you make me a copy? And he said he would. I said, well, why do you have a letter from him? He said, oh, we were college roommates. And I said, well, what's his deal? Where is he? He said, oh, he's down in New York City, living kind of rough. So he asked me if I felt like helping a down-on-his-luck folk singer. So I said, well, why not? So then the next weekend, I drove down to Queens, and I found him, and we had lunch and talked over a few things, and I decided I would help him. And that's how it started. and we went to his room, and he had a little fan and this cheap guitar. Got his glasses, a few items of clothing, and that was about it. Oh, a little tape recorder, and I started to cry because I don't know. I mean, I don't have a lot myself, but I got more than he did, and he was at that time, you know, in his 40s. He's almost 50. And I thought, this is so sad. And, you know, the whole time he's talking to me, and his voice is no more than a croak at this point, because he smoked. I told him I would do what I could to help him, and all it really took was a couple phone calls from that point. And that's how all that started.
Well, of course, over the years, you did quite a lot for him, and people who read your book, Jackson C. Frank, The Clear, Hard Light of Genius, will hear the whole story, which is really a touching and beautiful story and very, very well written. I want you to tell me another song that you think we should hear from this 3-CD set that just came out of all of his known recordings. I guess there might be some still out there.
I know there are, and it's killing me that I can't get my hands on them.
So let's play one more track, and which one should it be?
A Stitch in Time. It was recorded in 1974. It was one of the last things he recorded professionally, and I personally think it's the best thing he ever did.
Yesterday my time was torn. Someone told me I was born to lose. And in the darkness, it appeared to last almost 1,000 years as true. So in the morning, drunk with light, I turned my weary one-armed sight to you. Little kids and grown-up men, they gotta change and not know how or when or who. But baby thought it would leave me more to stand aside and unlock the door for you. Now it's if you can means if you will. If you will means if you're still for two. Loneliness unlocks each gate. Patience whispers, you're too late, it's through. And if I was there to keep the score, I'd just be there to feel the sore abuse. Oh, yesterday my time was torn. Someone told me I was born to lose. And in the darkness, it appeared to last almost 1,000 years as true.
The book is called Jackson C. Frank, The Clear, Hard Light of Genius, and the author, my guest, Jim Abbott. Jim Abbott, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you for having me. It's an honor, really. I appreciate it.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can like From the Bookshelf on Facebook, and you can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Jim Abbott, his new book, Jackson C. Frank, The Clear, Hard Light of Genius. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.